From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Fire crews in Northern California have made some progress overnight, beating back the most destructive of 17 wildfires burning in the state. The deadly car fire in Shasta County is burning about 2 hours north of Sacramento. And KQED reporter Sam Harnett is in Red Bluff, which is near Redding. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what's the latest on the car fire?
So the car fire now is 27% contained. That's up from 23% last night. And again, contained means that they've kind of circled it and cut it off from more fuel. And they've contained most of it that's near the city of Redding, which is the most populated area up here. But the fire is starting to burn more a little bit to the northwest up into Trinity County, which is less populated and more wild.
And what are firefighters saying in terms of when they think they'll be able to put this fire out? This is now the seventh most destructive wildfire in California history.
Well, there's no official timeline to totally contain the fire. Like I said, they've done a lot of work around Redding, which is more populated, and now it's spreading a little more into the wilderness, and, you know, it depends on the weather.
The weather is playing a big part in what's going on there. There has been intense heat, and it's been very dry. Many are pointing to climate change, although you can't, you know, say that one event is part of climate change, but this is certainly a very hot and dry year, and that is fueling these fires.
Right. I mean, volatile weather. I mean, heat has definitely been a factor. You know, it's been in the triple digits a lot. It's been a really hot summer. But there's also the wind. The wind around here kind of whipped this fire into, you know, people were describing as sort of a tornado of flame.
Right. Yeah, we've heard about that. And that's the first time that's happened in a long time in California. You met Elsa Ceja, who is part of a family that owns a Mexican restaurant in Redding. They're donating meals and supplies to people in need. Here she is.
We can't just, you know, take off. We have to be there for our community. They've been here for us for so many years, you know, supporting us. So it's time to be there.
And you also met a couple that runs a tortoise rescue center around the Redding area. This past weekend, they evacuated their 80 animals. Here's Katie Hoffman, who said it's been a crazy couple of days.
Not a lot of sleep, lots of headaches, and our babies come first. We're not leaving without them.
So, Sam, how is the community pulling together in this area where hundreds of buildings have already been destroyed? Six people have been killed just within a matter of hours last week.
Well, the first thing I'll say is, you know, there's a lot of people who have been at these evacuation centers. And, you know, the people at the evacuation centers are people who have had really nowhere to go. You know, they can't pay for a hotel or a friend. And, yeah, you've seen a lot of people there really struggling. You know, people are coming together there. I met some people who had become friends at the evacuation center. But, you know, it's pretty dire. You know, I met a lot of elderly. I met people, you know, who didn't have adequate fire insurance, you know, who looked kind of on the edge already. And this is kind of pushing them over. So it's, you know, it's been kind of rough there. But I will say the community is kind of drawing together. They had this community meeting last night. And, you know, residents there were talking. They were really appreciative of the first responders and firefighters. But they were really critical about information. You know, they felt like they weren't as updated as they wanted to be.
They want to have more information about what's going on maybe with their homes.
Well, yeah, and I would say there was this feeling of, like, in this time of smartphones and the internet, people kind of wanted, like, personal information. They wanted things delivered to their smartphones. They wanted personalized updates. And, you know, with a major fire like this, there's a lot of unknowns. You know, people, it's been days and people don't know what's happened to their houses.
Just briefly, there's also a major fire in straddling Mendocino and Lake counties. It's called the Mendocino Complex Fire, only 12% contained. What's the latest there?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a similar story. I mean, it's in a less populated area. This is about 100 miles north of San Francisco. It's less contained, but again, it's a less populated area. And, you know, these are two of more than a dozen fires that are burning across the state. I think there's a feeling here that these fires are just the new normal. As you said, people are looking at global warming and increased volatile weather conditions like drought and heat.
Right.
You know, it's already been another bad fire year, and there's been a bunch of bad fire years recently.
It's KQED reporter Sam Harnett in Red Bluff, California. Sam, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy.
Well, today is the first day of jury selection in the trial of Paul Manafort, accused of hiding the millions he made as a lobbyist for the then Putin-backed president of Ukraine before Manafort became Donald Trump's campaign manager. There also appears to be a new line of defense from the White House in regards to Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Initially, the Trump team said there were no contacts with Russians. When it was revealed there were, the meeting in Trump Tower, for instance, they insisted there was no collusion. Now, Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani says even if there was collusion, that's not a crime. Now, critics might say this is an administration in trouble, but the economy is going great guns. Conservatives are elated at the prospect of a Supreme Court nominee who might overturn Roe v. Wade. So let's bring back a Trump voter to hear out his view of this moment. Ben Clymer Jr. owns an auto body repair business in Riverside County, California. Ben, welcome back.
It's good to be with you, Robin.
And good to speak with you. Let's start with CNN's reporting that Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer, will testify about that meeting in Trump Tower in which Russian operatives promised dirt on Hillary Clinton but instead tried to talk to Trump's son about lifting sanctions. You know, coupled with how cozy President Trump was with Putin at that summit in Helsinki, are you unnerved about some of this reporting about the what's being revealed about contacts with Russians?
I think it would definitely depend on what's revealed during the hearings. I'm as interested in anybody else to see what is actually said during those hearings.
Yeah, President Trump doubled down on Twitter today. He tweeted out, collusion is not a crime. But that doesn't matter because there was no collusion except by crooked Hillary and the Democrats. Today, Chuck Rosenberg, who's a former FBI chief of staff, said this to MSNBC.
Collusion is a crime. We just happen to call it something else. We call it conspiracy, but it is absolutely a crime.
What do you think about this change in tone from the White House that suddenly, well, collusion's not a crime? Does that alarm you?
I think the changing in tone is not something that I'm feeling very comfortable about. Again, it depends on what actually happens.
So just what do you think about Trump inviting Putin to the White House when we know they meddled in the election, whether or not the Trump campaign was involved, and that they're still doing it?
I'm absolutely for improving relations with Russia, nations that have been historically so-called our opponents, just like I was a fan of what President Obama did trying to improve relations with Cuba as well. That doesn't condone messing or even contributing towards affecting the results of elections of other nations.
Right. Well, you're echoing what you said when we spoke in January, right after the State of the Union. You said then you didn't like the president being militaristic and you wanted to see more ways to seek, you know, peaceful relations. So given that, what do you think about his recent threats against Iran?
With Iran, I think, again, it's the same with Russia. I think their destiny belongs with their people. Our involvement in the Middle East has done nothing to stabilize the Middle East. In fact, our involvement continues, per the CIA's own words, cause blowback. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see the administration be supportive of the efforts of the Iranian people, but having military actions against Iran, I don't feel to be the best course.
You're very in favor of legal immigration. Your wife immigrated here legally. What do you think about how the president has handled immigration? His zero tolerance policy resulted in that separation of children and parents with no plan to reunite them. It was kind of a mess on the border there. How do you think he's been handling this?
So what President Trump has done is enforce existing laws. Obviously, that caused massive amounts of blowback, yet his point was valid. I've been asking for, ever since I was elected, for Congress to act, and they just refuse to find something that works.
Yeah. Let's look at the economy. We have a brief amount of time here, so we're hopscotching through the topics. And you run an auto body repair business there in California. The economy is continuing an upward trajectory that started before Donald Trump took office, as everyone knows. The jobless rate was 7.8% when President Obama took office in 2009. It was 4.8% when he turned the economy over to Donald Trump. In Donald Trump's 18 months, the jobless rate has fallen even further, 4% last month. And the economy's gross national product is doing great. Some of those big numbers recently might be farmers and manufacturers hurriedly trying to sell things before the tariffs hit. But are you feeling pretty good about the economy?
In our local economy, as well as regional, the economy is looking positive. People are optimistic. And you are correct. I think there's plays being made before the tariffs go into effect. Obviously, being very libertarian in my views, I'm not a fan of tariffs. If that's something the president is using as a tactical mean to get a better deal, I can understand that. But as far as tariffs themselves, I'm not in support of tariffs.
So Ben Clymer Jr., if I'm hearing you correctly, uneasy about the tariffs, looking forward to seeing what's revealed about the Russia investigation and possible complicity on the part of the, you know, members of the Trump campaign. a little uneasy about some aspects of President Trump's foreign policy. Where are you now in your thoughts on candidate Donald Trump, who you voted for as president?
So overall, my thoughts on candidate Trump and President Trump, he's been consistent on what he said during the campaign and what he's trying to do. He was willing to do the tariffs to get a better deal for America. He's carried out that threat. He's wanting stronger security at the border. He's carried out that as well. He promised to reduce the taxes. He has done that. He promised to end Obamacare. Congress failed to act, but at least he got the mandate repealed. I think he will see actually more people vote for him in 2020, perhaps not here in California. But if he continues to follow through with his campaign promises, he will find actually more supporters, not less.
Ben Clymer Jr., a Republican from Riverside County, California, a Trump voter, with his report card at this point. Ben, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
The city of Seattle is in a building boom, cranes across the skyline, new construction everywhere you look. Because of all the work, you'd think there might be a lot of construction worker injuries. But while the industry is still very dangerous, injuries are down. Anna Boyko-Wyrock from member station KUOW explains why that is.
Bob McCleskey says a lot has changed in the construction industry. On April 30th, an iron worker fell from the 20th floor of a high-rise in downtown Seattle, a high-rise McCleskey's construction company is building.
As the leader of a company, it's the worst nightmare, and you get a call, and I'm so thankful that, it worked out the way it did.
The worker fell 8 floors and landed in a net. McCleskey is the CEO of Celen Construction. He says 10 years ago, contractors didn't use a net like that.
It's really just the last 4 or 5 years where they've really been put in place around steel structures as they've been coming up to catch anything that drops over the edge.
But the nets are designed to catch falling tools, not falling people.
Caught up there.
A bystander shot video of the rescue. The falling worker in downtown Seattle was hurt badly, but he survived. But still, workers are getting hurt there at far lower rates than before. I looked at the past 20 years of data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which tracks injuries and illnesses. The rate in Washington state has steadily gone down since 1996 and is now more than 60% lower than it was before. I wanted to see what that looks like on the ground.
This is what we call a man lift.
Mandy Keim is in charge of safety for the Associated General Contractors, an industry group. She audits construction site safety, checking through a list of more than 200 points. Companies that do well during her audits get special recognition and shorter state safety inspections, too.
You can see Mohai from here, Lake Union.
Keim took me up to the 9th floor of Google's new building under construction in South Lake Union. Wind gusts by us. There are no walls or windows yet. Instead, between us and the open air are wood and metal handrails with bright orange netting. Keim says guardrail technology keeps improving.
So it's no longer, let's just slap up some 2x4 and call it good and just hope nobody leans on it. It is now, this is an engineered system.
I mean, Keim remembers before hard hats were standard in construction. Now, companies compete with each other for jobs using safety scores. Another common sight, when workers go beyond the guardrails, like to install glass walls, they suit up with a harness over their shoulders and legs connected to a line inside.
Some lines that we hook to are a static, almost bungee line system, and some of them that we hook to are called a yo-yo, where it's a line and it'll let you go out, but if you go out too fast, it'll retract and stop you.
The safety gear is important, and, Keim says, so is a company's attitude towards safety.
Really, what kind of culture are we creating out here? And do the workers feel supported and empowered to do the right thing? Do the management people walk the walk? Is this a safe place to be?
Falls are one of the top hazards for workers in construction. By the way, the man who fell off the high-rise in downtown Seattle recently was working behind a guardrail, so he wasn't hooked in at the time. Still, the guardrail didn't stop his fall. Contractors have to pay for injuries in pricey workers' compensation claims and higher insurance premiums. But avoiding injuries can get them a refund on workers' comp insurance. the state workers' comp system is seeing a drop in claims. Naomi Anderson analyzes injuries at the State Department of Labor and Industries.
Yes, we're happy that it appears that, you know, these rates are going down.
But there's a caveat.
Construction is still quite dangerous compared to all other industries.
More than 9,000 people got hurt or sick working construction in Washington state in 2016, according to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's twice the national rate for the industry. For Here and Now, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock in Seattle.
Well, as Seattle booms with construction, there's all the more reason to find an oasis in the city, something like what you'll find at the Waterfall Garden Park, which is described as a hidden gem. Nearly all cities have them, and our next guest, garden scholar and author of the book Green Escapes, has cataloged where to find what he calls urban oases. Toby Musgrave, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you so much for having me.
And what exactly is an urban oasis, and how is it different from just a park?
Well, the way I look at it is it's about scale, and it's also about knowing about these places. I think when it comes to big green escapes, like big parks, they're familiar. People know about them. And you can usually find a space within a big green space to call your own. But the aim of green escapes is to bring those less well-known, those smaller, those intimate, those hidden secrets to people's knowledge, and to introduce these little local secrets to a wider audience so people can just get away from the city for a few minutes here and there.
I was just recently at an event that was on the 9th floor of a building right in downtown Boston. And I got out on the 9th floor of the elevator. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I walk outside and it's like a huge grassy lawn right in the middle of the city. It was incredible.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that was so fun about researching the book is that there's such a diversity of different types of green escapes. So anything from roof gardens to, for example, in London, an old burnt out church that's being converted into a green escape, railway sidings that are being converted, old cemeteries, just the list goes on. And I think one of the delights about these smaller gardens and green parks is that is the surprise about coming across them.
Mm-hmm. There are 237 of these urban oases in your book. Have you been to all of them?
No, I wish I had. I think if I was to visit every single one, I'd still be doing the traveling now. I've been to about a third of them.
And what's your favorite so far?
It's almost unfair to say one over another. I mean, I can give you a couple of examples, the ones that I really just love also because of the cities. There's Parco Savello in Rome. I mean, Rome's one of my favorite all-time cities, and to go to this garden, which overlooks the Tiber, which is full of citrus trees, which smell gorgeous in the spring, and watch the sunset is quite special. And again, it's one of those places where very few people know it, so you kind of have the place to yourself if you're lucky. Another of my favorites, which is probably quite well known if you're in the know, is Paley Park in New York. But also another one in New York, which isn't so well known, when we were talking about gardens on roofs, there's the Elevated Acre, which is right down the end of Manhattan, which has a stunning view out over to over the river and over to Brooklyn as well.
Would you consider the High Line in New York to be an urban oasis?
I think it is. Definitely comes into that category. But one of the focal points of the book was to introduce gardens that are not so well known. And, you know, the High Line is a fantastic, fantastic place. But, it's so well known now that I just didn't want to include it because people are so familiar with it. But having said that, there's a lovely example of another repurposing of a railway line, the Rail Park in Philadelphia, for example, which has just opened its first phase this year. So the High Line is a great inspiration, and I think it was an incredibly innovative idea, although they kind of pinched the idea from Paris, but we'll leave it at that.
Well, and by the way, it's become one of the most popular tourist destinations in New York City at this point. This trend is not new, of course. You go back to a garden that you point out in the Tang Dynasty in China, 2,000 years old.
Yeah, I think sort of garden making is one of those activities that defies time, really. I think as soon as we stop becoming nomads and hunter-gatherers and settle down to be an agrarian society, I'm absolutely certain people would have taken a few flowers from the wild to create a space around their environment that was beautiful to be in. And there's perhaps no archaeological evidence for that, but that's come on through time.
What does it tell you about us in the year 2018 that, you know, we want to live in cities, many of us, but we also want these escapes in our cities?
I mean, I guess it's we live and work in cities because that's how civilizations and cultures have evolved. And it's also relatively convenient. Also, sometimes you get stuck in the traffic and may not think so. But personally, I think that us as a species, Homo sapiens, is kind of wired towards the green. It's where we evolved from originally. And I think we just respond very positively to areas that have that green growing area to them. We study after study from academics shows that, you know, using green spaces is beneficial both physically and mentally for our well-being. And I think that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is because, you know, we all spend time in cities. We get stressed out, whether we're working, whether we're commuting, whether we're living there, whether we're visiting as tourists. And sometimes we just need those sort of decompression chambers to just go, calm down, just revivify the soul. And green spaces do that for us. And I like these little ones because they have that sense of intimacy and privacy, which you can really feel yourself in. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
That's Toby Musgrave, who is a garden scholar and the author of the new book, Green Escapes. Toby, very interesting. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Tomorrow is the day it becomes legal for people to download blueprints to make their own plastic, undetectable, unlicensed guns. And 8 states and the District of Columbia are suing the Trump administration over its decision to allow that to happen. The company behind the guns, Defense Distributed, actually released the plans a few days ago for fear they'd be blocked. And at least 1,000 people have already downloaded the AR-15 data. But now even President Trump is skeptical. He tweeted today, "I'm looking into 3D printed plastic guns being sold to the public. Already spoke to the NRA. Doesn't seem to make much sense." Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Robin.
So these downloadable plans were first released online in 2013 by Cody Wilson. He ran into legal problems right away. But even the Trump State Department was against them, agreeing with others that they presented a national security risk. So they reversed that decision.
Very suddenly. In a settlement with the company that has done these things. But yeah, this has been downloaded already more than 100,000 times before it was blocked. So yeah, you're right. The State Department shut it down, saying that this violates all sorts of laws that would allow the guns to fall into the hands of foreign actors, basically terrorists. And the Obama administration did that. The State Department under Trump carried that on. And then suddenly it reversed course. The ban was said to lift tomorrow, but they put the plans on the Internet a little bit early. Mm-hmm. So it's been downloaded in the last few days more than 1,000 times. With it, you can print almost an entire gun. There are still a couple of parts you'll have to get, and of course, the ammunition.
Well, look, they can't be detected in metal detectors because they're plastic. They have no serial numbers. So there's a lot of concern here. Those behind the guns of the company are saying this is a First Amendment issue. They're comparing it to Nixon's attempts to block the Pentagon Papers.
Yeah, both a First Amendment and a Second Amendment issue. They're invoking the idea that it is actually about expression and about freedom of expression. And, of course, then relying on the Second Amendment. This gets legally very complicated. It's one of those things where that's why the State Department was involved as opposed to the Justice Department. And now it's there are a number of attorneys general who are suing the State Department to go back on this because it's a national security issue. It does take us down very interesting roads in the free speech discussion, but most people aren't sure that's exactly what this is.
Well, look, you mentioned these lawsuits filed by Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson, along with Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Oregon, Maryland, District of Columbia. What are they saying?
Well, they're concerned about this making guns untraceable, ghost guns, if you will. Never mind untraceable, you won't even know they existed. It's circum- circumvents a lot of regulations on gun control that have been deemed appropriate by various courts, including the Supreme Court. As you said, it becomes difficult to detect with metal detectors. Initially, when the guy made it, who did this, he put a piece of metal in it that could be detected, but he said that's not mandatory. You don't have to have that. So 21 state attorney generals have sent letters to Jeff Sessions and Mike Pompeo, because State Department's involved as well, but 8 of them have joined a lawsuit, and they're basically saying that this is deeply dangerous and could have an unprecedented impact on public safety. Okay. And keep in mind, you can't print the actual gun, but you can print the parts.
Right. Look, 22 seconds. A horse out of the barn on this, Ali Velshi?
Well, it's technology. And once you print something on the internet, it's really hard to get it back. And we do print a lot of things on the internet. But figuring out a way how to regulate guns that are printed at home is going to be important for us to do.
Yeah. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Continuing our series on summer books, may we suggest today Children of Blood and Bone. But don't take our word for it. Listen to Jimmy Fallon's announcement of his audience vote for favorite summer book.
The winning book that you voted for is Children of Blood and Bone.
Yeah!
The young adult novel Children of Blood and Bone takes place in the all-black mythical kingdom of Orisha. Maybe a nod to the divine spirits the Yoruba legend says were brought to the New World by slave ships. In this Orisha, magic has been banned. The magi who wielded it were killed by order of the king. Those who survived are second-class citizens called maggots. Zaylee, the daughter of a magi, and Amari, the daughter of the king, are thrown together to try to bring magic back. The book is already on its way to the big screen, and author Tomi Adeyemi is just turning 25 tomorrow. Tomi, when you heard Fallon, what did you think?
It was so exciting, and the week where the voting was taking place was so stressful because I could see it. But I think the most fun part about it, like, I just kept getting all these messages from readers, and they were like, just voted, and they would send me the percentages and be like, we're winning. And it was just this really cool sense of unity, like just that we. So many people kept saying, we're doing it. Come on, guys.
Well, what do you think they mean by we? And what are you hearing the book means to them?
I think one we is just when you're writing for young adults, they take this seriously.
Right.
And the stories they love, they will defend those stories. So it's really an honor to write for such a passionate and engaged group. And then I think the other part is being black and doing something to really show black people that they can be the heroes, that they can ride the giant lion, that they can have the epic adventure and love story. Mm. There's a collective we in that identity, because when, you know, when one black person wins, we feel like we all win because we know what we're fighting against.
Well, and you know, with that in mind, I thought, well, maybe one of your inspirations might have been Black Panther, the hugely successful film. But I'm reading that you were inspired to write this after The Hunger Games. So this was the movie adaptation, maybe like 2011.
Yeah. So my mission as a writer started after The Hunger Games.
Right.
After seeing the backlash against characters in the adaptation just because they were black, it was like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to write something so good and so black that even racists have to see it.
People were saying things like Rue, the
yes.
little girl who, I don't think I'm giving anything away here.
Yeah.
But she meets an untimely end, and every people had fallen in love with her. She was a black actress, and people were saying, oh, why are they making good characters black? Now, the author,
yeah.
Susan Collins, says, no, she was always black.
Yes, yeah. Yes, and that's the funny thing. There's always an intense backlash when a character that people, that at least was historically white, is played by an actress of color. But in this case, they are explicitly black on the page, yet a lot of people were like, oh, why'd they make all the good characters black?
Yeah.
Oh, it wasn't sad when Rue died because she was black. And these were like direct quotes being said. They weren't people hiding with anonymous like avatars. Like, it was their face.
Yeah.
It was their name. And I was just like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, so part of it was the horror that people could feel this way, especially about fictional characters. But the other part was that they didn't feel the need to hide. And that was also equally scary. Obviously, I'd encountered racism in my life, but it had been the one-off events, and a lot of times it had been hidden. They'll say, oh, I don't think she deserved to get into that school, but to my face they'll say congrats. Mm-hmm. But this was people saying horrible things and not feeling any shame or any need to hide, and that was really scary back then. And of course, it's only gotten worse now.
So here's what I have been dying to ask you. So you have this complete black culture. Every character is black with different skin colors. And this is, of course, a narrative that runs throughout Black history.
Yeah.
You know, what skin color means.
Yeah.
And so you have characters that are evil characters. That king comes to mind.
Yeah.
You've said, and others have read this as a sort of Black Lives Matter loosely cast in some fantasy land. But how can that be if, in fact, they're all Black characters?
Yeah. So that's the instant conundrum I created for myself, which you picked up on. I wanted to write a story about Black people, and I wanted to write a story about the Black experience. And the Black experience has a lot to do with Black pain, and that has a lot to do with white people. But I wanted to write a story with all Black people. So I'm already coming up against myself in doing that. And I also wanted to talk about colorism, but I wanted to also not perpetuate all the things I see often in media because of colorism, which is an elevation of light-skinned Black people over dark-skinned Black people. And so it's complicated. And I won't even go as far as to say that I did it perfectly, because inherently the things I wanted to do were directly in opposition of each other. But I was okay with everything not coming together perfectly, because it's like the story has to come first. And so what had to be perfect to me was the story.
Mm. Well, here's a thought. I'm white, and I'm reading it, and I know that they're of color. But as the book goes along, for instance, there's a princess who stumbles into this adventure that your main characters are going on. She's the typical damsel in distress when we first meet her. I started to see her as a spoiled, white, blonde princess.
Yeah. It's actually pretty funny that you say that. It is easy to start whitewashing, because that's what we're used to. We're still used to thousands of years of literature with just straight white people.
Yeah.
So that's another reason why I had to be deliberate about describing the tones and describing them again and again, because your mind starts to just automatically do what it's been more than trained to do.
Yeah. Look, it's been called the latest and applauded entry into the works of Afrofuturism, storytelling that's both the past and futuristic and fantasy.
Yeah.
There were so many details that, you know, screaming metaphor, the magi, who are called the maggots, can't hide because they have white hair.
Yeah.
You know, African-Americans cannot hide.
Yes.
That they are Black. I mean, were there other things like that that you were trying to?
Oh, definitely. I was very heavy-handed. And I think part of that comes from being an English major and always being very frustrated when they were like, pull a thesis out of these weak metaphors. And I'm like, this isn't what the author intended. So for me, it's very clear to see what I intended. Like, maggot is very similar to a slur used against Black people. Having stark white hair, like, you're not going to hide that in a room. A Black person can never hide that they're Black in a room.
You know, it's interesting. Van Newkirk writes in The Atlantic, the world that you have built, because you have to build a whole world, not just tell the story, follows closely on a lot of the major fantasy stories like The Hunger Games. There's usually all white characters or mostly white characters, but they're facing slavery, eugenics, police states.
Yes.
Things that African-American communities have long faced.
Yes, and that's the point. Science fiction stories and fantasy stories are stories of oppression. They always oppress a marginalized group. But the vast majority of these stories are written by people who aren't actually marginalized in our current society. So there's this sort of like, oh, what if there was dragons? Oh, and racism. You know, like it's this fantastical element when the things that are described in these horrible books are happening to people all across the world and all across America every single day.
Angie Thomas, the author, the fabulous author of the YA book, The Hate U Give, made a comment about that. Like, you know, really? What kind of problems are you facing?
Yeah. You know, I was talking to someone today and I was like, or she goes, I feel like people don't often talk about your experience as a Black woman while writing this. And I'm like, yes. And that experience means that I will be worried about missing my deadline, and I'm also worried about being shot by the police and being killed and not finishing the series at all. And it's not they're not outlandish fears, you know? It's very hard to live like that, and it's even harder to fight your way through that. But that's kind of what this book allowed me to do, because I was in that place before I started writing, even while I started writing.
Well, and as I was reading it, I mean, the scenes of battle and gore and distress are like way over the top. I mean, they're just hugely, you know, stadiums that fill with blood as people battle it out. But again, this with this idea of Afrofuturism, as much as they were futuristic, they were not at all. I mean, that's what happened with slave ships. And
yeah, you know,
people were lynched.
That's the funny thing. Yeah. People, when it first came out, I kept getting a lot, oh, it's so violent. It's so violent. And I was like, you know, every piece of conflict in this is based off of things that are happening today or things that have happened to black people as recently as 30 years ago, right? That's part of the reason I put an author's note at the back. I knew if I didn't explicitly stay within the text of the book that, hey, all of this is based off things that are happening to real black people today, that it would fly over a lot of people's heads. And they'd be like, oh, I felt so bad for Zaylee in chapter one, but they won't feel bad for the actual girl it happened to in Florida, you know? So it was very important for me to make it this big adventure, but to make all of it tied to reality so that people could, when they left the book, hopefully think about our world differently and be spurred to do something about it.
That's YA author turning 25, Tomi Adeyemi. Her book is Children of Blood and Bone. Tomi, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was really fun.
Oh, and she sold the movie rights to her bestseller for seven figures. Happy 25th birthday, Tomi. It's Here and Now.
Today, the Senate voted to renew the National Flood Insurance Program hours before it was set to expire during the height of hurricane season. The House passed a temporary extension for the program last week, authorizing it only through November. The Senate followed suit today.
Are there any senators wishing to vote or change their vote? If not, the yeas are 86, the nays are 12. The motion is agreed to.
Critics of the National Flood Insurance Program say it needs structural changes, not short-term extensions. Joining us now for more is Charlie Crist, former governor of Florida and a Democrat in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's in St. Petersburg, Florida. Congressman, welcome.
Jeremy, thanks for having me. It's always great to be with NPR.
Well, and you were among the members of Congress to vote last week to reauthorize the National Flood Insurance Program through November. Why a four-month extension? Why hasn't Congress been able to settle on a long-term solution for this program?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't know that anybody really knows the answer to that, but I do know that what we do need is a long-term extension. And, you know, sometimes elections can make a big difference. I anticipate that may be the case this November as well. If the change that a lot of people expect happens does happen and the House flips, we might have a new chairman and then possibly an opportunity to get the sort of long-term extension that the people really deserve that will guarantee a lot more sustainability, accessibility, and affordability, which is incredibly important, especially in a state like Florida.
How do you make this program sustainable, though? The flood insurance program is now more than $20 billion in debt.
Well, fortunately, not long ago, the House gave up half that debt. And I think what we need to do is go, look, who's the debt owed to? It's owed to the federal government. So the federal government can forgive the debt. I think that ought to be part of what we do in order to make it more affordable, obviously. And I think that's not an unlikely scenario.
But there are many who would say, why should the federal government be on the hook for this risk that people who live in places where they're likely to get flooded, you know, they're making that decision to live there. Shouldn't they be on the hook for whatever money it costs if there is a disaster?
Well, I can tell you as a Floridian, we have paid the lion's share into the National Flood Insurance Program. So that kind of accountability, if you will, already does exist through FEMA with this program. I mean, it's the same kind of question you might ask, you know, why would we go in after a Katrina in New Orleans or an Irma as last year in Florida and help out these states, you know, that have a natural disaster? Or more present, the wildfires in California. Because we're Americans and we're all in this together is the short and simple answer. And we care about each other. And that's why we have these kind of programs. That's why we take care of each other. And that's why they exist.
But on the same token, you could say, well, we don't have an unlimited amount of money to spend on these kinds of things.
Well, we have enough money to do it. Apparently, it's worked so far. And I think it's important that we continue to understand that we need to take care of our fellow Americans. You know, from my point of view, Jeremy, I think it would be a much better system if we had a national catastrophic fund. And people in Congress have been calling for this for some time. I think that, you know, if we're going to end up coming in, for example, after a Katrina anyway, or obviously, you know, once these wildfires are done in California, we're going to help those people in California. just like we helped people in the Northeast when the hurricane hit up there a few years ago. So, you know, if that's going to be the situation, why don't we go ahead and fund it up front? Make sure that we have, you know, good rates for people, a more stable system with a national catastrophic fund. I think that's the way we ought to be going in the future.
Do you think it is possible to effectively run this national flood insurance program when you have a government that in many cases isn't addressing climate change at all?
They're difficult to rectify with one another. There's no question about it. And I think it's very important. Listen, I believe in climate change. I know that it's happening. As a Floridian, we see it daily. We are probably the state most susceptible to sea level rise as a result of climate change. So, you know, the more we can get the federal government and this administration in sync with the idea and the reality that climate change is real, that'll only help support programs like National Flood Insurance that much more. Having that positive, enlightened attitude and understanding of what's going on with climate change across our planet.
Congressman, I want to ask you one more question while we have you. You were the governor of Florida from 2007 to 2011. The current governor, Rick Scott, a Republican, is running to unseat the Democratic Senator Bill Nelson. Who do you think has the edge in that race? It's been very close.
It is close. There's no question about it. I think it will probably continue to be close right up and until Election Day. I'm supporting Senator Nelson. I think he's done a great job for our state in the U.S. Senate. And I hope things work out well for him, because then they'll work out well for Florida and America.
It's Charlie Crist, former governor of Florida, now a Democrat representing St. Petersburg in the U.S. House of Representatives. Congressman, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Jeremy, we are now being marched off to have cupcakes to celebrate our 5 years as a two-hour NPR program.
Wish
we had a cupcake for everyone out there, but we'll be thinking of you out there as we have them.
I did a little calculation, Robin. Between the two of us in the last 5 years, I think there have been at least 10,000 interviews. Seriously.
I thought you were going to say 10,000 cupcakes.
No, not that many cupcakes. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.